Children, this past Friday, we celebrated Epiphany, which is the official end of the Christmas season. So if you haven't put your decorations away, then you're not behind. You're doing just fine. Christmas has just ended, and we still have ours up. So you're doing okay. During the Christmas Eve service and all that happens on Christmas, we read a lot from the Gospel of Luke. And the Gospel of Luke is just so darn cute. There's shepherds and cows and lambs and angels and so many parts to play and things to read. And it's this beautiful pageantry that we read there as Luke tells the story of Jesus' birth. And the account of Jesus' birth in Matthew is really just a couple sentences, and it's usually we relegate our celebration of Matthew to January 6th, which often gets lost, right? You saw how many kids were celebrating this past Friday. But the Matthew account is strange. It has dreams, and it has strangers coming from the east. It has people following a star. It's just kind of this bizarre tale of a little baby born, and the political drama that's happening around that as Herod finds out. But today we're talking about that Matthew account. And remembering as we talk about it that God tends to show up in strange places. God tends to show up in strange places. God tends to show up in the last places sometimes we think we want to look. The last places that we're looking. And it reminds me of when I think about God showing up and Revelation showing up in odd places, I think of this story by the Southern writer Flannery O'Connor. He's a wonderful writer, wrote a lot of great short stories. And one of my favorites is this story that she tells about this woman in Georgia named Mrs. Turpin. I don't think we ever find out her full first name. But Mrs. Turpin has the world figured out. She's got everyone, it all is like in this perfect stratified universe. And she knows exactly where she lands. She is a landowner. She is a churchgoer. She has some property, and she has some people working for her. And so she knows just right where she stands, and she is classifying people constantly. So we meet Mrs. Turpin in this doctor's office, where she's gone because her husband got kicked in the shin by a cow. And she is looking at every single person in this doctor's office and assessing them. And she uses words that I probably won't use here in church because they're inappropriate in 2012 in Oregon. But you can imagine in 1960s Georgia what words she was using as she classified every person in this office. And she placed herself, of course, in a very privileged place as the one who could assess everyone's appropriateness at that moment. But there was one person she couldn't figure out. It was the daughter of this very well-bred woman who she approved of, who was overweight, whose face was covered in acne, and whose head was buried in a book until she began to fix her eyes on Mrs. Turpin. And she began to stare at Mrs. Turpin with these blue eyes, and she began to scowl at her, and her lips were curling, and she just kept looking at her, and Mrs. Turpin couldn't figure out what was wrong. And of course, the conversation went on, and as the conversation went on, it was like this girl was seeing right through Mrs. Turpin. And finally, at some point, she took her book, and she hurled it across the room, and hit Mrs. Turpin right in the eye. And then she leaped across the room, across the table, and grabbed her by the neck and started trying to choke her. And this complete chaos ensues in the doctor's office, you can imagine. They're trying to pull the girl off, and the ambulance is called, and she's set away. But before she does, Mrs. Turpin comes up to her and says, "What do you want to say to me?" And she said, "Go back to hell, you old warthog." And so the dust settles, everyone goes home, Mrs. Turpin goes and takes a nap with Claude, her husband, And as she's laying there, she just can't get that image out of her mind. And she's arguing with her, I am not a hog. I am not a warthog. I am a respectable church-going woman. And everyone around her is saying, you know, it's not true. She's crazy, but she can't get it out of her mind that there may be something fair. And as she's, you have this image of her washing down the pigs, having a discussion with them, saying, I'm not like you. And she has this vision as the sun begins to go down. And she has this vision of a procession going up to heaven. And in the front of the line are, oh, I don't know if I can use these words, but I'm going to. It says in the story, the white trash and the black people that she had so harshly judged in front. And then behind, and they were going up and they were so happy, and behind them were all the respectable people like herself, who were in this same parade, behind all these other people that she had judged, going to heaven. Strange story, strange vision. But what was revealed in this strange, bizarre, and somewhat violent encounter to Mrs. Turpin was the truth about how she was looking at the world, about how she had everything so figured out, and she knew exactly how it was supposed to work. And all of a sudden, in the end, she realized everything was completely upside down from what she thought. And the Matthew story, likewise, is fantastically strange. It has scholars coming from the East whose area of study is the stars. And that's like an astrology and not at all what you should be studying as a Jewish person. So when they show up, it's like, you know, what would they have to say? What would they have to say to us at all? I was thinking about when I was in the 1970s and 80s growing up in a more evangelical world, you know, it was like the big thing was backmasking. Do you guys remember that? Oh, there's got to be some of you. So we'd play Beatles records backwards and listen to the, you know, evil messages from Satan that were coming through these records. And I thought maybe this astrology thing felt like, to the Jews, like backmasking, right? Like, how could there be anything good that came out of that? That's just totally out there. But here they come, and they're following the star. And so when the strangers bring strange news, and when we encounter strange things, it begins to reveal something about who we are. It begins to reveal how tightly we're holding on to whatever it is we're holding on to. For Herod, when he found out about this, it all of a sudden made him really, really revealed how tightly he was holding on to his power. There's a king born in, you know, a king of the Jews. Where is that? I need to figure that out because I'm the king of the Jews and that's my rightful place, and let's get this taken care of because I'm in charge. So for Herod, it revealed how tightly he was holding on to his power. For the Jewish scholars, they knew the right answer. They said, well, the baby's going to be born in Bethlehem, and that's where it goes. But it's curious that this thing that they were studying so well and they seemed to have so much knowledge about, they had no curiosity in following it and finding out what these scholars knew. So they gave the information, but they didn't go any further than that. And so neither Herod nor the Jewish scholars can see the star. And they don't have any of the joy that's awaiting for them in finding the baby, Jesus, because they're holding so tightly to needing to be right, to their own power. They're so invested in the way that they've structured the world that they can't even see what's ahead. So who is the stranger in your world? Maybe you think it's someone of a different political persuasion or a different theological belief, or someone with some sort of a disability. I knew one woman who was just petrified of people with disabilities because I think she held so strongly to her need to be strong and have everything together. Is there a family member that you struggle with, someone of a different background? Who or what makes you aware that you're holding on to something too tightly? What makes you kind of grab on and say, no, that can't be true. I have to be right. Have to protect what I know. And this week I was thinking, now am I preaching to the choir here? Because you guys are all a pretty open-minded group, in my opinion. There's a lot of diversity in this congregation. We live with it. We talk about it. Who is the stranger for us here in this place? And it took me all week to think about it and think about who it was for me, because, you know, I like to read new things, and I'm up for listening to a few stargazers every once in a while. And who is that stranger for me? And I realized the stranger for me is sometimes other pastors who I feel threatened by. Because they preach better than I do, or they write better than I do, or they have a job, you know, a more prestigious job in some way. That becomes the stranger for me, because it makes me cling more tightly to needing to be right. Sometimes the stranger for me is those really prophetic, out there people that are going to expose the ways that maybe I'm not living as simply as I should be. By driving the car that I drive, or by not recycling the way I should, or whatever it is, you know, and you don't want to hear those voices. You want to unfriend those people on Facebook. They make you so uncomfortable. But those are the strangers for me. That's where I start drawing up my boundaries a little bit tighter and making my walls a little bit stronger to keep out those voices. So who are those people, and what are those places for you? Who are those strangers? Now, I'm not talking about putting yourself in danger, not talking about losing your own smart boundaries around unhealthy relationships, not even talking about letting go of what you believe. But instead, it's how you hold all of those things, remaining open, listening, welcoming those strange ideas, and being willing to consider strange ideas, strange people, strange experiences as something that might help lead you to that star. The contrast between Herod and the Magi is so stark in this passage. Because Herod is holding so tightly and they are living so open. They're not afraid to ask questions. They're not afraid to say, we don't know where to go. Can you help us? They're not afraid to follow this crazy journey across the land to follow this star. They're just simply there to learn and explore and grow and engage. And they know that without the help of Herod and without the help of these Jewish scholars, they can't find where they're going. So they're gathering more information and learning more. They're not ruled by fear in the end. And I don't know what you usually think of as the opposite of fear or as the opposite of wisdom, but I thought maybe they are each other's opposite in this passage. That the opposite of fear is wisdom. The opposite of wisdom is fear. Because when we're so controlled by fear, then we can't open ourselves up to the wisdom that may be around us. We can't hear where God is speaking to us. We can't see the star that is leading us to Christ. I love the story of Babette's Feast, another short story, and also a movie. The story was written by Isak Dinesen, a Norwegian writer, about this small Lutheran sect in a small town in Norway, very pious and very ascetic. They ate the plainest food, they dressed in the plainest dress, and there were these two sisters who were the leader's daughters, and they had been keeping this way of life their entire life. They had never allowed themselves to fall in love or to marry. They lived very simple life. And this woman arrives as a refugee at their door, and she becomes their cook. And it turns out that she is, without their knowledge, she is the premier cook in Paris. She had been the cook at the Café Anglais. And she could cook the world's most amazing food, but the sisters ordered her to just cook the simple broth and bread and what they had eaten the rest of their lives. And she did that without a complaint. But she won $10,000 in the French lottery. And she decided that she wanted to cook a feast for them in honor of their father's, his birthday, I think. And so she cooks this feast, spends all 10,000 francs to cook the most fabulous feast. Now the sisters began to get worried as they saw things like wine and turtles arriving at their doorstep. And so they agreed with all of their friends that they weren't going to comment on this meal. So no one said anything except for the one general who was visiting from out of town. He was the one that was effusive and said he'd never had food like this except for at the Café Anglais. But everyone else ate the meal in complete silence. Yet afterwards, when they began to talk, the ties, the people that had been separated began to come together. And the people who had been a little bit dour and sour began to loosen up. And they really began to enjoy each other and experience grace in a way they hadn't as a result of this feast. And it's an interesting reminder, because how often does fear keep us from commenting on the dinner, from truly seeing and appreciating and knowing what's in front of us? And yet we live in this world where grace comes through and we enjoy it and we see it. One last story. When my daughter Emmy was 5, I took her to the farmer's market in a town in California where every Tuesday they have live music while they have the farmer's market. And a lot of the homes for people with mental disabilities come and bring the residents to the park on Tuesday mornings. And so they sit and they listen to the music and they eat their lunch and they dance to the music. And so I was sitting there with Emmy and she was munching away on her tamale and she began to ask me about some of these people out there. And I was trying to explain to a 5-year-old, you know, how to explain mental disability to a 5-year-old and, you know, that their brains didn't work the same way as ours did. And she said to me after a while, "So, if you're not very smart, then you dance." I thought, wow, well, I didn't do a very good job at that, right? So I said, no, Emmy. If you're smart, you start dancing. It's those of us who are just sitting here that aren't very smart. And so she munched away for a little bit longer and she said to me, "I want to go dance." I said, "Okay, let's go dance." And so she went up to these people that were strange to her. And they were blowing bubbles and they were dancing. And she chased bubbles for about 15 minutes. And we found out their names and we gave them hugs and it was time to go. And we said goodbye. And it was just this most beautiful moment of welcoming the stranger, of going and dancing, of letting go a little bit of things that we hold so tightly to, like our propriety and our need to be right and our position and our power, and dancing. So this new year, may you dance. May you be aware of those places that feel a little strange, that cause you to shrink back. And maybe it is even just that feeling that will guide you to dance a little bit more in this world. Let's pray.